Good morning. God has a plan concerning authority in this world. If we were to turn to Romans chapter 13, it says, there's no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. And I think we all have a good understanding of what that means. And generally speaking, from the pulpit or in church settings, we usually have a series of topics that go along with this. Sometimes we'll hear people talk about God's supreme authority over mankind. Sometimes we'll hear people talk about a father's authority in his family concerning his wife and children. Sometimes we'll hear about the authority of the civil government. Sometimes about the church offices, including the elders, the deacons, evangelists, and their relationships with the members. And sometimes we'll even hear about the relationship between employers and employees. Well, today I wanted to take a slightly different look and take a look at the authority appointed to us by God in concerns to animals, to nature, and basically our responsibilities. The main scripture that I want to look at today was printed on the front of your bulletin. If you look at Genesis chapter 1, and you might keep your thumb there because I'll be turning back and forth there throughout this talk. Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. It says, and it's pretty familiar to each one of us. It reads, then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. You see, this is the authorization command that God gave to man as to how to act with his handiwork here on earth, how to act over nature, how to act over animals, and how to act over the natural resources. Today I want to look at three things. I want to look at the world's interpretation of these scriptures, how they might apply them. Secondly, I want to look at specifically some key words that I've written up here to help us to direct our actions. And thirdly, I want to look at what our specific responsibilities and limitations are towards nature and maybe answer the question, how does God expect us to act? Well, if you were to run a Google search for man's dominion or man's authority over animals, I'll just tell you, you get about 500,000 results in about 1/10 of a second. There's a lot of stuff out there. And some of that stuff, well, some of it's good, some of it's bad, and some of it's really bad. So you always have to be kind of careful. First thing I want to do is I want to take a quick look at what some worldly people think concerning these verses. So the pendulum definitely swings, and you have to be kind of careful at what you look at on the internet, obviously. And some people take the word subdue in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, to imply that creation will not do man's bidding easily or gladly, and it's up to man to bring it under submission by force, under strength. You see, while creation is not to rule over mankind, there's a certain twistedness about mankind, about humanity, that causes us to perform this task with a destructive delight. This view uses this verse sort of loosely, well, really loosely, I would think, to rationalize some of the following. To abuse animals, to tear down forests unjustly, to strip mine the ground and to leave it an inhabitable mess, to hunt and kill endangered species and animals just in excess or just for sport. And I've even seen it used, this is really kind of crazy, to rationalize oil spills, and that it's okay to have oil spills. It's totally fine. So that pendulum that's swinging back and forth, that's sort of one extreme side. But you know, it keeps swinging, and there's the other extreme side too. So it can definitely swing in this opposite direction. In this scenario, man does not subdue creation at all, but instead it puts it on a pedestal. It loves it. It adores it. It invites it into their homes. You know, it puts it on a pedestal. It puts it before their family, puts it before their friends, and eventually it puts it before God. That's definitely a problem. This includes people that put the rights of animals above the rights of mankind. And recently I read some stories about this on the internet, and I wanted to pinpoint two of these just to kind of show you just how far this logic can go. And feel free to laugh at these, because I definitely did as I was reading them. There's an anti-phishing campaign out there. And in this campaign, they actually were to dressing fish up in kitten costumes. And they proposed that just as you wouldn't harm your cute pet kitten, you shouldn't harm the kittens of the sea either. So that's kind of how far that went. There's also an anti-hunting campaign. And it started off with a bumper sticker that just said, "Your daddy kills." Your daddy kills. Later it progressed into something I just don't even understand. But it encouraged children to run away from home whose parents were hunters. Whew. All right. Let's go to something completely different, because that's just disturbing. The first chapter of Romans, in part, it talks about how man is without an excuse in terms of knowing God's existence. If you were to turn to Romans 1, starting in verse 20. Romans 1, verse 20. It says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, so that they are without an excuse." Verse 21 talks about how they denied God and changed things around. Verse 22 says, "Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God, into an image made like corruptible man." You see, they turned the beauty of creation, of God's handiwork, into an idol. It mentions specifically birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Verse 25 says, "They exchanged the truth of God for the lie." The truth of God for the lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. These people have put the rights of animals above the rights of mankind. They've made idols out of animals, and eventually they made animals their gods. Well, it kind of summarizes some of the points that you can see out in the world, and I did specifically pick some extreme versions, just so you can kind of see some of the things that are out there and some of the logic that people think about. So let's dig a little bit deeper into Genesis 1:28 if your thumb is still there. And instead of relying on the internet for information, let's rely on God's holy word. Let's take a look at two words. I've written them on the board up here. I don't claim to be a Greek scholar, but sometimes taking a look at the Greek terms and what they mean and kind of the context helps us to derive some of the meaning out of the terms. The first word is subdue. In Hebrew, it's the word kabesh. And you can't get around it. It does mean to subdue. Could mean to enslave. Can even mean, in some of the harshest instances, to molest or to rape. But there's a catch with this term. It only means this when the party being subdued, is already hostile. So in most cases in the Old Testament, it's used to speak primarily of military enemies in scriptures. So, for instance, if there was an army and they were approaching Lee Summit, they started to attack Lee Summit, if we were not to subdue it, if we weren't to stop this army from attacking us, our inaction would lead to death for us, right? Because if there's an army attacking, we do nothing to subdue it, to stop it, it would eventually lead to death for us. In the same manner, I think we can derive the idea that we are to subdue those things on the earth, which without us subduing them would cause death for us. So for instance, if there was a wolf population or a mountain lion population somewhere around a community, I think it'd be okay to subdue those to stop that from, you know, harming the people there. Additionally, if there was a flooding river somewhere around a city and it was going to cause destruction, I think it's okay definitely for us to subdue that or to stop it. Used to talk about the forgiveness of sins, the word is also used in Micah chapter 7, verse 19. Micah 7, verse 19, it says, "He," talking about God will subdue or kabesh our iniquities. As God subdues that which leads to death in us, sin, as he subdues that which leads to death rather than life, so too we are called to subdue in nature what leads to death, turning it around so that it can yield life. Jesus' words about pruning in John chapter 15 provide a beautiful example of the way that God subdues sin, using as an analogy the way that a farmer subdues nature. This is John chapter 15. The first two verses, I think we're pretty familiar with the verses. John chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Jesus speaking says, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit." In this analogy, God, the vine dresser, he prunes or rewards those who bear fruit or life-giving substance. Those who do not bear fruit, who do not produce life-giving substance, are cut off. In that same chapter, these branches are burned. Using this same logic, agriculture and other life-giving uses of nature are proper fulfillment and use of the scriptures, the command to subdue creation. You see, we stop the things that cause death, and we encourage those things that are life-giving, such as agriculture, and etc. Now let's take a look at the word dominion. The word dominion or rule is translated from the Hebrew word radah. And there's a royal connotation to this word, the word radah. We would think of it as the dominating rule of a king. Today the word dominate has a bad connotation, making one think of the violence and the tyranny of an overpowering source. But a benevolent king can also show respect. He can nurture his loyal subjects in his domain. So let's pause and think of the kind of king that God desires us to be as we rule with nature, rule the earth over in his domain. The word radah is used in Psalm 72. It's used in Psalm 72, which speaks of the rule of the Messiah, our king. Psalm 72, verse 8 says, "He shall have dominion, radah, from sea to sea." If we were to skip down to verses 12 through 14 of Psalm 72, we'd see that what that radah is to look like. It says, "For he will deliver the needy when he cries, the poor also. From him who has no helper, he will spare the weak and needy, and he will save the souls of the needy. He will redeem their life from oppression and violence, and precious shall be their blood in his sight." Now this sounds like the kind of king that I want to have rule over me. And I think it's the type of king that God would choose to have him to have rule over his dominion. Well, what kind of king does God not want us to be? What kind of king does he not want? If we turn over to Ezekiel chapter 34, Ezekiel chapter 34 gives us an example. This is a tirade that against Israel's kings, God says through his prophet, he says, starting in verse 4, it says, "You have not strengthened the weak. You have not healed the sick. You have not bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strayed. You have not sought the lost. But with force and harshness, you have ruled over them." With force and harshness. This does not sound like the type of king that God really wants us to be. If he was to give us or entitle us to a certain area of dominion, I don't think this is necessarily the type of king that he wants us to be. So if your thumb's still back in Genesis chapter 1, I want to look specifically at verse 26. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. It uses the words likeness, as well as the word image. They're used to describe man's similarity to his creator. We read Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. It says, "God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion." See, God made us to be special. God made us different from the beasts of the field. He gave us souls. He gave us self-discipline. And he gave us intelligence to rule. I think specifically from this scripture, We can also take out that he, to imply that man's likeness to God also included, I mean, among other things, the fact that we're given a dominion. See, while God is the ruler, the supreme ruler of the entire universe, I think it's safe to say that he sort of delegated a portion of his authority to us here on earth. And no such grant was given to any of the lower animals. I mean, God never had some new revelation to the lions saying that, you know, they'll be king of the jungle or anything like that. And nor would the animals really be able to rule. They just don't have that ability. But being created in the likeness of God, we're the only creation fit to rule. And given that responsibility, we must rule under the headship of God as he intends us to do so. The dominion that God desires is one that protects the defenseless and gives justice to the oppressed. Applying this to the command for humanity to exercise dominion over creation, we can see that while we rule over creation, we're also called to protect it, as a king protects his subjects from marauding invaders. As a king accepts tribute or taxes from his citizens, his subjects, so too we receive a bountiful sustenance from the fruits of creation or from animals. Also, as a king should take care of the weak and the poor of his kingdom, so too we are called to guard the natural beauty, preserve the endangered species of God's creatures, and even to restore the places that we've, you know, too often ruled with force and harshness. So our specific responsibilities. I'm not saying that agriculture or all these things are wrong. I'm saying that agriculture and harvesting natural resources from the ground, such as, you know, gasoline or oil and precious minerals, I think it's fine. We just need to be sure that we don't go too far and destroy the land and make it inhabitable for future generations. I think forestry is fine. We just can't destroy the only natural habitat of animals that are subject to us. I think hunting is fine. But I don't think that we should kill at such levels of excess just to satisfy mere pleasure or greed. Hunt with reason. I think we need to protect life where it needs to be protected, just as a just king would over his dominion. You see, man's made the sea his highway to the ends of the earth, the stars his pilots on a pathless ocean, and the sun his bleacher and his painter. The bowels of the earth, the treasury from which he draws his precious and useful metals, and much of his fuel, the steam his motive power, and the lightning, electricity his messenger. These are proofs of the ever-growing influence, the power, the dominion of man on this earth. Can the dominion go too far? I think so. Will we rape the earth of its resources, pollute its oceans and streams with our man-made poisons, or enslave and grossly mutate livestock with hormones and fattening agents, or slaughter its peaceful animals for its fur, or just for our pleasure? I think that's going too far. Will that pendulum swing too far in the other direction, though? Will we cherish an unborn eagle within an egg more than an unborn human in his or her mother's womb? Will we hold week-long picketing over animal cruelty when human rights are being overlooked? Will we worship the creature rather than the created? I think God has a detailed plan for us, and it's been set out ever since the beginning of time. We're to be good stewards of his creation, subduing that on the earth that leads to death, just as God subdues sin in our lives that leads to death. We're to rule and have dominion over his creation, the animals and the earth's natural resources, as a benevolent king would shepherd and guide his flock. As the writer of Luke says in Luke 12:48, to whom much is given, of him much is required. It's our tradition to have a gospel invitation at this time. And as God's given us authority, he's given us some authority here on earth. He's also given us feet that we should walk in his way. He's given us hands that we should do his work. He's given us a heart that we can feel what people have going on in their lives and that we can reach out to them. He's given us a voice so that we can spread the gospel. And he's given us a choice A choice to follow Him, to be obedient to His call, to trust Him, to obey Him in His words, or to be disobedient, to not follow Him, to follow our own folly, to do our own thing. It's our choice, the choice that He gives us. And if you feel that you need to make that choice public, that choosing to be obedient, to trusting Him, to obeying His gospel call, please come forward as we stand and sing number 644.